Welcome to the Full Money Radio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:16 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is January 7th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week, and it's been a week in which the Santa Claus rally ran out for commodities. And precious metals took a little bit of a hit in here this week, and gold finished out the week below, well, just below the $1,370 level. Silver is below $29 at the close in here today. Palladium was down a tad as well. It's back to the $750 area, and platinum is currently around $1,740. This was also a week in which some of the soft commodities, particularly those that have been most overextended relative to the 200-day moving averages, pulled back also fairly sharply. So this was a fairly volatile week for the sugar market, for coffee, and for cocoa. The primary grains, which are wheat, corn, and soybeans, were a little bit softer in here today, but have held on to the vast majority of their gains over the last couple of weeks. And I think the market is, to a certain extent, holding its breath as we approach the January 12th announcement from the USDA. In the meantime, the volatility in the commodity complex is likely to remain, and there are quite a lot of speculative long positions out there. At least part of the reason that commodities have come under a bit of pressure this week is because the US dollar has been a bit stronger, and particularly against the euro. The Spanish and Portuguese governments have got to raise quite a bit of cash in the bond markets over the next 2 months, and the yields on all of the peripheral Eurozone countries have been rising. So there is continued worries about the Eurozone, and that is feeding into the currency, it's feeding into those government bond markets, and indeed into the stock markets of those peripheral countries. With the relative weakness of the euro, the dollar has actually strengthened up against a large basket of currencies, not least the yen, where it had two very good days in here this week, and it finished out the week just a little bit off its high. As a result of the yen at least pausing in its advance, the Japanese market has been one of the better performers over the last week, and it posted some pretty solid gains in the middle of this week, and it takes the Nikkei and the topics, and indeed the second section, back to the middle of their bases. And for the Nikkei, that's around the 10,500 level, but it really does need to get substantially above 11,000 to break out of this base, and to indicate that not only has demand returned in the short term, but in the medium term as well. There's a lot of people have been talking about Japan as a recovery candidate in 2011, and that's largely indicative of if we look over the last 3 years. 2009 was largely about a big rebound from deeply oversold levels, and the markets that performed best in 2010 were those that had really sound fundamental stories. So in 2010, we saw that the ASEAN markets outperformed in no uncertain terms. We saw that the commodity-producing Latin American markets did extraordinarily well, particularly those smaller markets that are more leveraged to commodity exports than their own domestic environments. This was also a year in which the growth of the global economy overshadowed the slow growth or moribund growth prospects of the USA and a good section of the Eurozone, particularly the Eurozone that's focused on the domestic European economy. Global growth was truly impressive in 2010. It has every prospect of being equally impressive in 2011. And the companies that did best in 2010 were those that are leveraged to global growth. So that's a good big section of Asia. It's a big section of Latin America. It's the export hubs of Europe, so much of Northern Europe, including Germany and the Netherlands, also Austria, and indeed a lot of Scandinavia. In 2010, the dividend aristocrats came into their own because there is a large section of blue chip companies that pay reliable dividends, that have a dominant position in their relative niches, and have true leverage to the growth in the global economy. So one is getting a perhaps not a world-beating yield, but a reliable yield with solid capital appreciation prospects from those dividend aristocrats. And they have also performed really quite well over the last year. But with Japan, it's been a serial underperformer. And it's representative of a trend that following 2 years to the upside, and whereas at the beginning of 2009, you could have looked around and said that there was a lot of bargains out there. And at the beginning of 2010, you could look around and say, well, there's still a lot of things that have got good solid upside potential. And I think you can probably still say that to a certain extent in 2011. But there's still a large section of markets that haven't gone anywhere in the last 2 years, and they're serial laggards. And people are starting to look at those and say, well, what are the ones that have the best catch-up potential? And there's a number of different categories in there, and I'll come to them in a moment. The dominant theme that was partially interrupted by the global financial crisis is the greatest urbanization in history. It's the fact that you have not just millions, but billions of new consumers entering the global economy, where the massive population centers of the world are either building new cities in the case of China and moving hundreds of millions of people out of abject poverty and into the middle classes, or you, in other countries, you have they are at an even earlier stage where they have massive young populations, where they have hundreds of millions of people coming out of their teens into their most productive years. And that is going to be the dominant theme over the next decade and potentially even longer than that. And part of the reason that you had those Asian markets and indeed India performing so well last year was because interest rates were so remarkably low and because they're most leveraged to that growth in the global economy. Now, if we identify what the really big theme is, then we can take another step and look at which of the laggards are most leveraged to that theme. And Japan certainly has the demographic time bomb going against it, and probably more importantly than that, an inept political system. But Japan is home to a large number of globally significant companies, and they're in need of a catalyst to spark investor interest. And we've identified that catalyst repeatedly as a weaker yen. And it's not game, set, and match, but the yen's advance has certainly paused. And it wouldn't take too much of a rally for the US dollar to turn that yen uptrend around. But we're not there just yet. So the Japanese markets are firming from the lower side of their bases, but they are still in need of that catalyst, which is a yen that gets significantly weaker to really spark investor interest in the country and to help to support that export sector. Perhaps the market that is most in tune with the growth of the global economy, the urbanization theme, and the masses of young people entering their most productive stages is Vietnam. And Vietnam went through a phenomenal bull and has been languishing in a base formation for much of the last 18 months, but it has firmed somewhat over the last couple of weeks, and probably the last couple of months, if I'm more accurate. And the Vietnamese market has got solid recovery potential, but it's probably still a little bit early in its recovery process to be able to say that with with a great degree of confidence that it's entered a new bullish phase, but it's certainly got solid recovery potential. And there's much of Eastern Europe, particularly those markets that are have got the more solid fiscal outlooks. And Estonia, which has just joined the Eurozone, is probably one of the better fiscally managed countries in the region. And its stock market is performing reflective of that solid fiscal position. Middle Eastern markets have also been serial laggards, and they do participate in the urbanization theme, and they also have massive young populations which are entering their most productive stages. What they have in terms of their urbanization and the potential dynamism of the young populations, they're lacking to a certain extent in their standards of corporate governance. And that is something that is probably going to hold them back for a little bit while longer. Now that leads us to the oil price, and oil has held above the $80 level for much of the last few months. And it's currently around the $88 level, so it hasn't held above $90. But it would be a positive. It would be a positive for the global economy if commodities were not to move into a massive bubbly phase and accelerate higher from here. Commodities have had a phenomenally good run over the last few months, and we're seeing some of the most overextended uptrends getting checked in here. Those that are less overextended, such as aluminium or lead, haven't had nearly the same pullback. And in fact, both aluminium and lead are consolidating in the region of their April highs, and they both look like that they have solid upside potential, particularly when one compares them to the overbought conditions that are evident in both copper and in tin. So, to a certain extent, there's a little bit of a passing of the torch in terms of leadership from some of the better performers in 2010 into some of the laggards. But probably the more important point is that provided these commodities sustain the majority of their advances over the last year, that secular bull market is still very much intact. And over the last year, we've seen a number of these commodities breaking upwards to new nominal highs. And it's really rather instructive clicking through the inflation-adjusted charts section of the chart library, because we're seeing that a large number of food commodities, in addition to the precious metals, are breaking out of 30-year downtrends in terms of inflation-adjusted pricing. So while some of these commodities are a bit overextended in the very short term, they are in secular bull markets. They're almost universally better bought following their reactions, and the sector is volatile, so it is prone to large pullbacks, and they have almost certainly, without exception, been opportune moments to enter those markets. Gold has this reputation for being a store of value in inflationary times, and inflation is certainly being built into the system. We have the Fed telling us that they're pursuing an inflationary path, that they will keep going until they get the inflation that they're pursuing. And that inflation is quickly developing in food prices. We've had these food prices breaking out of 30-year downtrends in terms of inflation-adjusted prices. And inflation is quickly becoming a problem in a number of emerging markets which are, I suppose, whose inflationary measures are more susceptible to higher food prices. And that's particularly the case in India. The Indian banks were a leading sector for the last 18 months. They found support early, they broke upwards early, they rallied more, they hit their high, they broke to new all-time highs first. But they've also pulled back faster, and they're now testing their 200-day moving average, and that Bombay Banks Index in the region of 12,000 It is at an area where it does need to find support to sustain the medium-term consistency of its uptrend. The bank sector has often been a leader, not just in India, but just about everywhere, because bull markets depend on the availability of credit, and banks are in the business of extending credit. So, in any bull market where you don't have bank participation, banks don't necessarily have to lead. They often do lead because in bull markets, the purveyors of credit should do well. And in India, the banks have led to the downside, and they're at this area where they really should find support. And that's a potential worry. But the India is probably many people's favorite market for the very long term. But we also know that India is susceptible to occasional extreme volatility. So there's probably a short-term risk that we get a deeper pullback, or that the main Indian indices move into a ranging phase and consolidate in the region of their prior highs. A potential example is something like we saw with the Nasdaq, because the Nasdaq was also a leading market from the March 2009 lows. It rallied remarkably impressively, but then in April of last year, it hit a medium-term peak and spent a good 9 months consolidating. And it was a very volatile period. It held on to the vast majority of its gains, but it was a difficult trading environment for at least 6 of those months. And potentially, that is what we could see with the Indian market, where it has rallied so remarkably persistently, where interest rates are beginning to rise, where inflationary pressures are quickly becoming a political liability, and where the rupee is being allowed to appreciate to combat some of those inflationary pressures. And that's going to put a little bit of pressure on the export market. So there is potential that India is in for a bit of a pause in here. But going back to the Nasdaq, it's been remarkably firm over the last 6 weeks in particular. And the Nasdaq 100 broke upwards to new recovery highs over the last few weeks. And particularly when one looks at some of the leading shares on the Nasdaq, and there is an impressive array of shares on the Nasdaq that have not only broken upwards out of long-term basis, but there's a number that are breaking to new all-time highs. And there's a large number of those shares are overextended relative to their 200-day moving averages. So we're also at a potential period where some of those markets move into a lengthier ranging phase, or they pull back to their 200-day moving averages. There's basically two ways that a market's going to revert to its mean. And reversion to a mean is pretty much a mathematical fact at some point. So they're either going to pull back fast, or they're going to go sideways and allow the moving average to catch up. And we've seen so far that some of the best performing markets last year, particularly Indonesia, have been ranging, going sideways for the last almost 4 months. So that's been a ranging consolidation, which has allowed the 200-day moving average to unwind a good part of the overbought condition. And some of those Nasdaq shares are really quite overextended relative to those 200-day moving averages. And the ideal situation would be that they hold the majority of their gains, or they move into relatively similar reactions compared to what they've done previously, and allow those 200-day moving averages to catch up. But what we can see from a quick click-through of a lot of markets is that even in the best-performing markets, so many are relatively overextended compared to their 200-day moving averages that it would then appear to be only a matter of time before we get some pullback and consolidation of recent gains. We're certainly beginning to see some of that in the commodity markets, and there's a certain amount of it also coming through on the stock markets. Just as Stock markets have rallied remarkably impressively over the last 3 months, and particularly over the last month. US government bonds and sovereign bonds generally have been pretty weak over the same period, and US treasuries have fallen from a high in September in the region of 136 down to just under 121 at the closing here today. And that's a pretty big move. And it probably completes a medium-term top. But just as a number of so-called risk assets are relatively overextended to the upside, US treasuries are also a little bit overextended on the downside. So, given the fact that treasuries have been rallying for the last 30 years and that US government bond yields have been falling for the better part of 30 years, it's unlikely that we're ever going to see the yields that were posted following the financial crisis anytime in the foreseeable future. Significant rallies in US government bonds are likely to be shorting opportunities for probably the better part of my career. I probably anticipate being David's age before seeing anything like the shorting opportunities that are currently evolving in the treasury markets. And this is not something that we're going to see crashing in all likelihood, because the US government can still intervene in this market. But the arguments for why someone should be very bullish of US treasuries are becoming increasingly shrill. One characteristic of absolutely every major bull market is that supply explodes at the top of the market. And supply of bonds of all hues is exploding right now, with just about every corporation attempting to lock in record low yields. And everyone else, if they could, would be doing the same thing. Governments are being forced to do that because they've nationalized so much private debt. And the answer for how any government is going to pay off debts that are completely unrecognizable is they're going to pursue an inflationary path. And they've told us that in no uncertain terms, and we're seeing that in the commodity prices right now. So long-dated government bonds are, in all likelihood, going to be a lousy investment choice for the foreseeable future. And attention is much more likely going to be paid to assets that can hold their value. And among those, gold is certainly on the in the first couple of candidates, but also you have the dividend aristocrats, and there is a significant quotient of really healthy companies that pay solid dividends and that pay a higher dividend than long-dated government bonds. So the cult of the equity is far from dead, and particularly those companies that offer that growth to the or leverage to growth in the global economy have got unique selling features that investors are increasingly coming to appreciate. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.